taking notes. Henri is waiting for me as usual. Bernie Kosar propped up on the passenger seat with his tail wagging, thumping the side of the door the second he sees me. I slide in.
Athens, says Henri.
Athens?
Athens, Ohio.
Why?
That's where the issues of the Walk Among Us are being written and printed. It's where they are being mailed.
How did you find that out?
I have my ways.
I look at him.
Okay. It took 3 emails and 5 phone calls, but now I have the number.
He looks over at me.
That is to say, it wasn't all that hard to find with a little effort.
I nod. I know what he is telling me. The Mogadorians would have found it just as easily as he did, which means, of course, that the scale now tips in favor of Henri's second possibility, that somebody got to the publisher before the story further developed. How far away is Athens?
2 hours by car.
Are you going?
I hope not. I'm going to call first.
When we get home, Henri immediately picks up the phone and sits at the kitchen table. I sit down across from him and listen.
Yes, I am calling to inquire about an article in last month's issue of The Walk Among Us.
A deep voice responds on the other end. I can't hear what is said. Henri smiles.
Yes,
he says, then pauses.
No, I am not a subscriber, but a friend of mine is.
Another pause.
No, thank you.
He nods his head.
Well, I'm curious about the article written on the Mogadorians. There was never a follow-up in this month's issue as expected.
I lean in and strain to hear, my body tense and rigid. When the reply comes, the voice sounds shaken, disturbed. Then the phone goes dead.
Hello?
Henri pulls the phone away from his ear, looks at it, then brings it back in.
Hello,
he says again. Then he closes the phone and sets it on the table. He looks at me.
He said, don't call here again. Then he hung up on me.
Chapter 18. After debating it for several hours, Henri wakes up the next morning and prints door-to-door directions from here to Athens, Ohio. He tells me he'll be home early enough so we can go to Thanksgiving dinner at Sarah's house, and he hands me a slip of paper with the address and the phone number of where he's going. Are you sure this is worth it? I ask.
We have to figure out what's going on.
I sigh. I think we both know what is going on.
Maybe,
he says. But with full authority and none of the uncertainty usually accompanying the word. You do realize that you would tell me if the roles were reversed, right? Henri smiles.
Yes, John. I know what I would say, but I think this will help us. I want to find out what they have done to scare this man so badly. I want to know if they have mentioned us, if they are searching for us by means that we haven't yet thought of. It will help us to stay hidden, stay ahead of them. And if this man has seen them, we'll learn what they look like.
We already know what they look like.
We knew what they looked like when they attacked over 10 years ago, but they might have changed. They've been on Earth a long time now. I want to know how they're blending in.
Even if we know what they look like, by the time we see them on the street, it's probably going to be too late.
Maybe. Maybe not. I see one. I'm going to try and kill it. There's no guarantee it's going to be able to kill me,
he says. This time, with the uncertainty and none of the authority. I give up. I don't like a single thing about him driving to Athens while I sit around at home, but I know my objections will continue to fall on deaf ears. You sure you'll be back on time? I ask.
I'm leaving now. Which puts me there about 9. I doubt I'll stay more than 1 or 2 at the most. I should be back by 1.
So why do I have this? I ask, and hold up the slip of paper with the address and phone number. He shrugs.
Well, you never know.
Which is precisely why I don't think you should go.
Touché,
he says, bringing an end to the discussion. He gathers his papers, stands from the table, and pushes in the chair.
I'll see you this afternoon.
Okay, I say. He walks out to the truck and gets inside. Bernie Kosar and I walk out to the front porch and watch him drive away. I don't know why, but I have a bad feeling. I hope he makes it back. It's a long day. One of those days where time slows down and every minute seems like 10. Every hour seems like 20. I play video games and surf the internet. I look for news that might be related to one of the other children. I don't find anything, which makes me happy. That means we're staying under the radar, avoiding our enemies. I periodically check my phone. I send a text message to Henri at noon. He doesn't reply. I eat lunch and feed Bernie, and then I send another. No reply. A nervous, unsettled feeling creeps in. Henri has never failed to text back immediately. Maybe his phone is off. Maybe his battery has died. I try to convince myself of these possibilities, but I know that neither of them is true. At 2 o'clock, I start to get worried. Really worried. We're supposed to be at the Harts in an hour. Henri knows the dinner is important to me, and he would never blow it off. I get in the shower with the hope that by the time I get out, Henri will be sitting at our kitchen table drinking a cup of coffee. I turn the hot water all the way up and don't bother with the cold at all. I don't feel a thing. My entire body is now impervious to heat. It feels like lukewarm water is streaming over my skin. And I actually miss the feeling of heat. I used to love taking hot showers, standing under the water for as long as it lasted, closing my eyes and enjoying the water hitting my head and running down. It took me away from my life. It let me forget about who and what I am for a little while. When I get out of the shower, I open my closet and look for the nicest clothes I have, which are nothing special. Khakis, a button-down shirt, a sweater. Because we live our life on the run, all I have are running shoes, which is so ridiculous it makes me laugh. The first time I've laughed all day. I go to Henri's room and look in his closet. He has a pair of loafers that fit me. Seeing all his clothes makes me more worried, more upset. I want to believe he's just taking longer than he should, but he would have contacted me. Something has to be wrong. I walk to the front door, where Bernie is sitting, staring out the window. He looks up at me and whines. I pat him on the head and go back to my room. I look at the clock. It's just after 3. I check my phone. No messages, no texts. I decide to go to Sarah's, and if I don't hear from Henri by 5, I'll figure out a plan then. Maybe I'll tell them Henri is sick and that I'm not feeling well either. Maybe I'll tell them Henri's truck broke down and I need to go help him. Hopefully, he shows up and we can just have a nice Thanksgiving dinner. It will actually be the first one we've ever had. If not, I'll tell them something. I'll have to. Without the truck, I decide I'll run. I probably won't even break a sweat, and I will be able to get there faster than I would in the truck. And because of the holiday, the roads should be empty. I say goodbye to Bernie, tell him I'll be home later, and take off. I run on the edges of the fields, through woods. It feels good to burn some energy. It takes the edge off my anxiety. A couple times I get up near full speed, which is probably somewhere around 60 or 70 miles per hour. The cold air feels amazing, whipping across my face. The sound of it is great, the same sound I hear when I stick my head out the window of the truck as we're driving down a highway. I wonder how fast I'll be able to run when I'm 20 or 25. I stop running about 100 yards from Sarah's house. I'm not short of breath at all. As I walk up the driveway, I see Sarah peek out the window. She smiles and waves, opening the front door just as I step onto her porch. "Hey, handsome," she says. I turn and look over my shoulder to pretend she's talking to somebody else. Then I turn back around and ask her if she's talking to me. She laughs. "You're silly," she says, and punches me in the arm before pulling me close to give me a lingering kiss. I take a deep breath and can smell the food. Turkey and stuffing, sweet potatoes, Brussels sprouts, pumpkin pie. "Smells great," I say. "My mom has been cooking all day. Can't wait to eat." "Where is your dad?" "He got held up. He should be here in a little while."
"Is he okay?"
"Yeah, it's not a big deal." We go inside and she takes me on a tour. It's a great house. A classic family home with bedrooms on the second floor, an attic where one of her brothers has his room, and all of the living spaces, the living room, dining room, kitchen, and family room on the first floor. When we get to her room, she closes the door and kisses me. I'm surprised, but thrilled. "I've been looking forward to doing that all day," she says softly when she pulls away. As she walks towards the door, I pull her back to me and kiss her again. "And I'm looking forward to kissing you again later," I whisper. She smiles and punches me on the arm again. We head back downstairs and she takes me to the family room, where her two older brothers, home from college for the weekend, are watching football with her father. I sit with them, while Sarah goes to the kitchen to help her mother and her younger sister with dinner. I've never been that into football. I guess, because of the way Henri and I have lived, I've never really gotten into anything outside of our life. My concerns were always with trying to fit into wherever we were, and then getting ready to go somewhere else. Her brothers and her father all played football in high school. They love it. And in today's game, one of her brothers and her father like one of the teams, while her other brother likes the other team. They argue with each other, taunt each other, cheer and groan, depending on what's happening in the game. They've clearly been doing this for years, probably for their entire lives, and they're clearly having a great time. It makes me wish Henri and I had something, besides my training and our endless running and hiding, that we were both into and that we could enjoy with each other. It makes me wish I had a real father and brothers to hang out with. At halftime, Sarah's mother calls us in for dinner. I check my phone and still nothing. Before we sit down, I go to the bathroom and try to call Henri, and it goes straight to voicemail. It's almost 5 o'clock, and I'm starting to panic. I come back to the table where everyone is sitting. The table looks amazing. There are flowers in the center, with placemats and table settings meticulously placed in front of each of the chairs. Serving dishes of food are spread around the inside of the table, with the turkey sitting in front of Mr. Hart's place. Just after I sit down, Mrs. Hart comes into the room. She has taken off her apron and is wearing a beautiful skirt and sweater.
"Have you heard from your dad?" she says.
"I just tried calling him. He's running late and asked us not to wait. He's very sorry for the inconvenience," I say. Mr. Hart starts carving the turkey. Sarah smiles at me from across the table, which makes me feel better for about half a second. The food starts being passed, and I take small portions of everything. I don't think I'm going to be able to eat very much. I keep my phone out and on my lap and have it set to vibrate if a call or text comes through. With each passing second, however, I don't believe anything is going to come through, or that I will ever see Henri again. The idea of living by myself, with my legacies developing, and without anyone to explain them to me or train me, of running on my own, of hiding on my own, of finding my own way, of fighting the Mogadorians, fighting them until they are defeated or I am dead, terrifies me. Dinner takes forever. Time is moving slowly again. Sarah's whole family peppers me with questions.
I've never been in a situation where I've been asked so many things by so many people in such a short period of time. They ask about my past, the places I've lived, about Henri, about my mother, who, I say, as I always do, died when I was very young. It's the only answer I give that is even the smallest sliver of truth. I have no idea if my answers even make sense. The phone on my leg feels like it weighs 1,000 pounds. It doesn't vibrate. It just sits there. After dinner, and before dessert, Sarah asks everyone to go out to the backyard so she can take some pictures. As we go outside, Sarah asks if something is wrong. I tell her I'm worried about Henri. She tries to calm me down and tell me everything is fine, but it doesn't work. If anything, it makes me feel worse. I try to imagine where he is and what he's doing, and the only image I can bring is him standing before a Mogadorian, looking terrified and knowing he's about to die. As we gather for the pictures, I start to panic. How could I get to Athens? I could run, but it might be hard to find my way, especially because I would have to avoid traffic and stay off the major highways. I could take a bus, but it would take too long. I could ask Sarah, but that would involve a huge amount of explaining, including telling her I was an alien and that I believed Henri had either been captured or killed by hostile aliens who were searching for me so that they could kill me. Not the best idea. As we pose, I get a desperate urge to leave, but I need to do it in a way that doesn't make Sarah or her family mad at me. I focus on the camera, staring directly into it, while trying to think of an excuse that will get the least amount of questions. I'm racked with full-on panic now. My hands begin to shake. They feel hot. I look down at them to make sure they aren't glowing. They're not. But when I look back up, I see the whole camera is shaking in Sarah's hands. I know that somehow I'm doing it, but I have no idea how or what I can do to make it stop. A chill shoots up my back. My breath catches in my throat, and at the same time, the glass lens of the camera cracks and shatters. Sarah screams, then pulls the camera down and stares at it in confusion. Her mouth drops open, and tears well up in her eyes. Her parents rush over to see if she's okay. I just stand there in shock. I'm not sure what to do. I'm bummed about her camera and that she's upset about it, but I'm also thrilled because my telekinesis has clearly arrived. Will I be able to control it? Henri will be beside himself when he finds out. Henri. The panic returns. I clench my hands into fists. I need to get out of here. I need to find him. If the Mogadorians have him, which I hope they don't, I'll kill every damn one of them to get him back. Thinking quickly, I walk over to Sarah and pull her away from her parents, who are examining the camera to figure out what has just happened. I just got a message from Henri. I'm really sorry, but I need to go. She's clearly distracted, glancing from me to her parents. Is he all right? Yes, but I have to go. He needs me. She nods and we kiss gently. I hope it's not for the last time. I thank her parents and her brothers and sister, and I leave before they can ask me too many questions. I walk through the house, and as soon as I'm out the front door, I start running. I take the same route home that I took to get to Sarah's house earlier. I stay off the main roads, run through the trees. I'm back in a few minutes. I hear Bernie Kosar scratching at the door as I sprint up the drive. He's clearly anxious, as though he also senses something amiss. I go straight to my room. I retrieve from my bag the piece of paper containing the phone number and address Henri gave me before leaving. I dial the number. A recording comes on.
I'm sorry. The number you are trying to reach has been disconnected or is no longer in service.
I look down at the piece of paper and try the number again. The same recording.
Shit!
I yell. I kick a chair and it sails across the kitchen and into the living room. I walk into my room. I walk out. I walk back in again. I stare in the mirror. My eyes are red. Tears have surfaced, but none are falling. Hands shaking. Anger and rage and a terrible fear that Henri is dead consume me. I squeeze my eyes shut and squeeze all the rage into the pit of my stomach. In a sudden burst, I scream and open my eyes and thrust my hands towards the mirror, and the glass shatters, though I am 10 feet away. I stand looking at it. Most of the mirror is still attached to the wall. What happened at Sarah's was no fluke. I look at the shards on the floor. I reach a hand out in front of me, and while concentrating on one particular shard, I try to move it. My breathing is controlled, but all the fear and anger remain within me. Fear is too simple a word. Terror. That is what I feel. The shard doesn't move at first, but then, after 15 seconds, it begins to shake. Slowly at first, then rapidly. And then I remember. Henri said that it's usually emotions that trigger legacies. Surely that is what is happening now. I strain to lift the shard. Beads of sweat stand out on my forehead. I concentrate with everything that I have and everything that I am, despite all that is going on. It's a struggle to breathe. Ever so slowly the shard begins to rise, 1 inch, 2 inches. It is a foot above the floor, continuing up, my right arm extended, and moving with it until the shard of glass is at eye level. I hold it there. If only Henri could see this, I think. And in a flash, through the excitement of my newly discovered happiness, panic and fear return. I look at the shard, at the way it reflects the wood-paneled wall, looking old and brittle in the glass. Wood. Old and brittle. And then my eyes snap open wider than they ever have before in all of my life. The chest. Henri had said it. Only the two of us can open it together. Unless I die, then you can open it yourself. I drop the shard and sprint from my bedroom into Henri's. The chest is on the floor beside his bed. I snatch it, run into the kitchen, and throw it on the table. The lock in the shape of the Lorik emblem is looking me in the face. I sit at the table and stare at the lock. My lip is quivering. I try to slow my breathing, but it is useless. My chest is heaving as though I just finished a 10-mile sprint. I'm scared of feeling a click beneath my grip. I take a deep breath and close my eyes. Please don't open, I say. I grab hold of the lock. I squeeze as tightly as I can. My breath held, vision blurry. The muscles in my forearm flexed and straining, waiting for the click. Holding the lock and waiting for the click. Only, there is no click. I let go, and slouch in the chair, and hold my head in my hands, a small glimmer of hope. I run my hands through my hair and stand. On the counter, 5 feet away, is a dirty spoon. I focus on it, and sweep my hand across my body, and the spoon goes flying. Henri would be so happy. Henri, I think. Where are you? Somewhere and still alive, too. And I'm going to come get you. I dial Sam's number, the only friend besides Sarah I've made in paradise, the only friend I've ever had, if I'm to be honest. He answers on the second ring. Hello? I close my eyes and pinch the bridge of my nose. I take a deep breath. The shaking has returned, if it ever left in the first place. Hello, he says again. Sam? Hey, he says. Then, you sound like hell. Are you okay? No. I need your help. Huh? What's happened? Is there any way your mom can bring you over? She's not here. She's working a shift at the hospital because she gets paid double time on holidays. What's going on? Things are bad, Sam. and I need help.
Another silence, then. I'll get there as quickly as I can.
You sure?
I'll see you soon.
I close my phone and drop my head to the table. Athens, Ohio. That is where Henri is. Somehow, some way. That is where I have to go. And I need to get there fast. Chapter 19. While I wait for Sam, I walk through the house lifting inanimate objects up in the air without touching them. An apple from the kitchen counter, a fork in the sink, a small potted plant sitting beside the front window. I can only lift the small things, and they rise in the air somewhat timidly. When I try for something heavier, a chair, a table, nothing happens. The three tennis balls Henri and I use for training sit in a basket on the other side of the living room. I bring one of them to me, and as it crosses his line of sight, Bernie Kosar stands at attention. Then I throw it without touching it, and he sprints after it. But before he can get to it, I pull it back. Or, when he does manage to get it, I pull it from his mouth, all while sitting in the chair in the living room. It keeps my mind from Henri, from the harm that may have found him, and from the guilt of the lies I'll have to tell Sam. It takes him 25 minutes to ride his bike the 4 miles to my house. I hear him ride up the drive. He jumps off of it, and it crashes to the ground, while he runs through the front door without knocking, out of breath. His face is streaked with sweat. He looks around and surveys the scene.
"So what's up?" he asks.
"This is going to sound absurd to you," I say, "but you have to promise to take me seriously."
"What are you talking about?"
"What am I talking about?" "I'm talking about Henri. He has disappeared because of carelessness, the same carelessness he has always preached against. I'm talking about the fact that when you had that gun on me, I told you the truth. I am an alien. Henri and I came to Earth 10 years ago, and we are being hunted by a malicious race of aliens. I'm talking about Henri thinking that he could somehow evade them by understanding them a little more, and now he is gone. That is what I am talking about, Sam. Do you understand?" But no, I can't tell him any of these things. "My dad's been captured, Sam. I'm not entirely sure by who or what is being done to him, but something has happened. And I think he's being held prisoner, or worse." A grin spreads on his face.
"Get out of here," he says.
I shake my head and close my eyes. The gravity of the situation again makes it difficult to breathe. I turn and stare pleadingly at Sam, tears well up in my eyes. I'm not kidding. Sam's face becomes stricken.
"What do you mean? Who has captured him? Where is he?"
"He tracked the writer of one of the articles in your magazine back to Athens, Ohio, and he went there today. He went there, and he hasn't come back. His phone is off. Something has happened to him. Something bad." Sam becomes more confused.
"What? Why would he care? I'm missing something. It's just some stupid paper."
"I don't know, Sam. He's like you. He loves aliens and conspiracy theories and all that stuff," I say, thinking quickly. "It's always been a stupid hobby of his. One of the articles piqued his interest, and I guess he wanted to know more, so he drove down."
"Was it the article on the Mogadorians?"
I nod. "How did you know?"
"Because you looked like you'd seen a ghost when I mentioned it on Halloween," he says, and he shakes his head. "But why would somebody care if he asked questions about a stupid article?"
"I don't know. I mean, I would imagine these people aren't the sanest in the world. They're probably paranoid and delusional. Maybe they thought he was an alien, the same reason you aimed a gun at me. He was supposed to be home by 1 and his phone is off. That's all I can say." I stand and walk to the kitchen table. I grab the slip of paper with the address and phone number of where Henri is gone. "This is where he went today," I say.
Do you have any idea where it is? He looks at the slip, then at me.
You ought to go there?
I don't know what else to do.
Why can't you just call the cops and tell them what happened?
I sit down on the couch, thinking of the best way to respond. I wish I could tell him the truth, that the best case scenario with the cops getting involved would be Henri and I leaving. The worst case would be Henri being questioned, maybe fingerprinted, thrust into the sluggish paced bureaucracy which would give the Mogadorians the chance to move, and once they find us, death is imminent. Call which cops? The ones in Paradise? What do you think they would do if I told them the truth? It would take days for them to take me seriously, and I don't have days.
Sam shrugs. They might take you seriously. Besides, what if he just got held up, or his phone broke? He might be on his way home now.
Maybe, but I don't think so. Something feels off, and I have to get there as soon as possible. He was supposed to be home hours ago.
Maybe he got into an accident.
I shake my head. Maybe you're right, but I don't think you are. And if he's being harmed, then we're wasting time. Sam looks at the sheet of paper. He bites his lip and remains silent for 15 seconds.
Well, I know vaguely how to get to Athens. No idea how to get to this address once we're there, though.
I can print directions from the internet. I'm not worried about that. The thing I am worried about is transportation. I have $120 in my room. I can pay someone to drive us, but I have no idea who I would ask. There aren't exactly a whole lot of taxis in Paradise, Ohio.
We could take our truck.
What truck?
I mean my dad's truck. We still have it. It's sitting in the garage. It hasn't been touched since he disappeared.
I look at him. Are you serious? He nods. How long has it been? Does it even still run?
8 years. Why wouldn't it still run? It was nearly new when he bought it.
Well, let me get this right. You're suggesting we drive there ourselves, me and you, 2 hours to Athens?
Sam's face twists into a devious smile. That's exactly what I'm suggesting.
I lean forward on the sofa. I can't help but smile as well. You know we'll be in deep shit if we get caught, right? Neither of us has our license.
Sam nods. My mom will kill me. And she'll maybe kill you, too. And then there is the law. But yeah, if you really think your dad is in trouble, what other choice do we have? If the roles were reversed and it was my dad who's in trouble, I would go in a second.
I look at Sam. There isn't an ounce of hesitation on his face in his suggesting that we drive illegally to a town 2 hours away. And that's not to mention that neither of us knows how to drive, and that we have no idea what to expect once getting there. And yet, Sam is on board. It was his idea, even. All right, then. Let's drive to Athens, I say. I throw my phone in my bag, make sure everything is zipped and in order. Then I walk through the house, taking everything in as though it will be the last time I see any of it. It's foolish thinking, and I know I'm merely being sentimental, but I'm nervous, and there is a sort of calming sensation to it. I pick things up, then I set them down. After 5 minutes, I am ready. Let's go, I say to Sam.
You want to ride on the back of my bike?
You ride, I'll jog alongside.
What about your asthma?
I think I'll be okay. We leave. He gets on his bike. He tries to ride as fast as he can, but he's not in great shape. I jog a few feet behind and pretend that I'm winded. Bernie follows us as well. By the time we get to his house, Sam is dripping with sweat. Sam runs into his room and comes out with a backpack. He sets it on the kitchen counter and goes to change his clothes. I peer inside of it. There is a crucifix, a few cloves of garlic, a wooden stake, a hammer, a blob of silly putty, and a pocket knife. You do realize these people aren't vampires, right? I say when Sam walks back in.
Yeah, but you never know. They're probably crazy, like you said.
And even if we were hunting vampires, what the hell is the silly putty for? He shrugs.
Just want to be prepared?
I pour a bowl of water for Bernie Kosar, and he laps it all up immediately. I change clothes in the bathroom and remove the door-to-door directions from my bag. Then I walk out and through the house and into the garage, which is dark and smells of gasoline and old grass clippings. Sam flips on the light. Various tools have rusted with disuse and hang on the pegboard walls. The truck sits in the center of the garage, covered with a large blue tarp that's coated with a thick layer of dust. How long has it been since this tarp was removed?
Not since Dad went missing.
I grab one corner. Sam takes the other. And together, we peel it away, and I set it in the corner. Sam stares at the truck, his eyes big, a smile on his face. The truck is small, dark blue, room inside for only two people, or maybe a third if they don't mind an uncomfortable ride sitting in the center. It will be perfect for Bernie Kosar. None of the dust from the past 8 years has made it onto the truck, so it sparkles as though it was recently waxed. I throw my bag into the bed.
My dad's truck, Sam says proudly. All these years, it looks exactly the same.
Our golden chariot, I say. Do you have the keys? He walks to the side of the garage and lifts a set of keys from a hook on the wall. I unlock the garage door and open it. Do you want a paper, rock, scissors to see who drives? I ask.
Nope,
Sam says. And then he unlocks the driver's side door and gets in behind the wheel. The engine cranks over and finally starts. He rolls down the window.
I think my dad would be proud to see me driving it, he says.
I smile. I think so too. Pull it out and I'll close the door. He takes a deep breath and then puts the truck in drive and slowly, timidly, inches it out of the garage. He hits the brakes too hard too soon, and the truck slams to a stop. You aren't all the way out yet, I say. He eases his foot off the brake and then inches the rest of the way out. I close the garage door behind him. Bernie Kosar jumps up and in of his own volition, and I slide in beside him. Sam's hands are white-knuckled at the 10 and 2 positions of the wheel. Nervous? I ask.
Terrified.
He'll be fine, I say. We've both seen it done 1,000 times before. He nods.
Okay, which way do I turn out of the driveway?
We really going to do this?
Yes, he says.
We turn right then, I say, and head in the direction away from town. We both buckle our seat belts. I crack the window enough so that Bernie Kosar can fit his head out, which he does immediately, standing with his hind legs on my lap.
I'm scared shitless, Sam says.
Me too. He takes a deep breath, holds the air in his lungs, and then slowly exhales.
And away we go,
he says, taking his foot off the brake when he says the last word. The truck goes bouncing down the driveway. He hits the brakes once, and we skid to a stop. Then he starts again and inches down the drive, more slowly this time, until he stops at the end of it, looks both ways, and then turns out onto the road. Again, slow at first, then gaining speed. He is tense, leaning forward. And then, after a mile, a grin begins to form on his face, and he leans back.
This isn't so hard.
You're a natural. He keeps the truck close to the painted line on the right side of the road. He tenses every time a car passes in the opposite direction, but after a while, he relaxes and pays the other cars little attention. He makes one turn, then another, and in 25 minutes,
We pull onto the interstate. I can't believe we're doing this, Sam finally says. This is the craziest shit I've ever done. Me too. Do you have any plan when we get there?
None whatsoever. I'm hoping we'll be able to scope the place out and go from there. I have no idea if it's a house or an office building or what. I don't even know if he is there.
He nods. Do you think he's okay?
I have no idea, I say.
I take a deep breath. We have an hour and a half to go. Then we'll reach Athens. Then we'll find Henri. Chapter 20. We drive south until, nestled in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, Athens comes into view. A small city sprouting through the trees. In the waning light, I can see a river curling gently around that seems to cup the city, serving as the border to the east, south, and west. And to the north lie hills and trees. The temperature is relatively warm for November. We pass the college football stadium. A white domed arena stands a little beyond it. Take this exit, I say. Sam guides the truck off the interstate and turns right onto Richland Avenue. Both of us are elated we made it in one piece, and without being caught.
So this is what a college town looks like, huh? I guess so, Sam says.
Buildings and dorms are on each side of us. The grass is green, meticulously trimmed, even though it is November. We drive up a steep hill. At the top of this is Court Street. We want to turn left.
How far are we? Sam asks.
Less than a mile.
Do you want to drive by it first?
No.
I think we should park the first opportunity we get and walk. We drive down Court Street, which is the main artery in the center of town. Everything is closed for the holiday. Bookstores, coffee houses, bars. Then I see it, standing out like a jewel.
Stop!
I say. Sam slams on the brakes.
What?
A car honks behind us. Nothing. Nothing. Keep driving. Let's park. We drive another block until we find a lot to park in. By my guess, we are a 5-minute walk at most from the address.
What was that? You scared the crap out of me.
Henri's truck is back there, I say.
Sam nods.
Why do you sometimes call him Henri?
I don't know. I just do. Sort of a joke between us, I say, and look at Bernie Kosar.
Do you think we should take him?
Sam shrugs. He might get in the way.
I give Bernie Kosar a few treats and leave him in the truck with the window cracked. He is not happy about it and begins whining and scratching at the window. But I don't think we'll be long. Sam and I walk back up Court Street, the straps of my bag pulled over my shoulders, Sam holding his in his hand. He has removed the silly putty and is squeezing it, like people do with those foam balls when they're stressed. We reach Henri's truck. The doors are locked. There is nothing of importance on the seats or dash. Well, this means two things, I say. Henri is still here, and whoever has him hasn't discovered his truck yet, which means he hasn't talked. Not that he ever would.
What would he say if he talked?
For a brief moment, I had forgotten that Sam knows nothing of Henri's true reasons for being here. I've already slipped and called him Henri. I need to be careful not to reveal anything else. I don't know, I say. I mean, who knows what sorts of questions those weirdos are asking?
Okay, now what?
I pull out the map to the address Henri had given me that morning. We walk, I say. We walk back the way we came. The buildings end and houses begin. Unkempt and dirty looking. In no time at all, we reach the address and stop. I look at the slip of paper, then at the house.
I take a deep breath.
This is us, I say. We stand looking up at the two-story house with gray vinyl siding. The front walk leads to an unpainted front porch with a broken swing hanging unevenly to the side. The grass is long and untended. It looks uninhabited, but there is a car in the driveway at the rear. I don't know what to do. I remove my phone. It is 11:12. I call Henri even though I know he won't answer. It's an attempt to establish my wits, to come up with a plan. I hadn't thought this far ahead, and now that the reality is here, my mind is blank. My call goes straight to voicemail.
Let me go knock on the door, Sam says.
And say what?
I don't know, whatever comes to my mind.
But he doesn't get a chance to, because just then, a man walks out of the front door. He is huge. At least 6'6", 250 pounds. He has a goatee, and his head is shaved. He's wearing work boots, blue jeans, and a black sweatshirt pulled up to his elbows. There is a tattoo on his right forearm, but I am too far away to see what it is. He spits into the yard, then turns around and locks the front door, walking off the porch and heading our way. I stiffen as he approaches. The tattoo is of an alien holding a bouquet of tulips in one hand, as though offering them to some unseen entity. Then the man walks right past us without saying a word. Sam and I turn and watch him go.
Did you see his tattoo? I ask.
Yeah, and so much for the stereotype of scrawny nerds being the only ones fascinated by aliens. That man is huge and mean-looking.
Take my phone, Sam.
What? Why? He asks.
You have to follow him. Take my phone. I'll go into the house. It's obvious there is nobody there, or he wouldn't have locked the door. Henri might be in there. I'll call you as soon as I can.
How are you going to call me?
I don't know. I'll find a way. Here. He reluctantly takes it.
What if Henri isn't in there?
That's why I want you to follow that guy. He might be going to Henri now.
What if he comes back?
We'll figure it out. But you have to go now. I promise I'll call you the first chance I get. Sam turns and looks at the man. He is 50 yards away from us now. Then he looks back at me.
Okay, I'll do it. But be careful in there.
You be careful too. Don't let him out of your sight, and don't let him see you.
Not a chance.
He turns and hurries after the man. I watch them go. And once they vanish from sight, I walk up to the house. The windows are dark, each one covered with a white shade. I can't see in. I walk around to the back. There is a small concrete patio leading to a back door, which is locked. I walk the rest of the way around the house, overgrown weeds and bushes left over from summer. I try a window. Locked. All of them are locked. Should I break one? I look for rocks among the brambles, and the second I see one and lift it from the ground with my mind, an idea occurs to me. An idea so crazy that it just might work. I drop the rock and walk to the back door. It has a simple lock, no deadbolt. I take a deep breath, close my eyes in concentration, and grab hold of the doorknob. I give it a shake. My thoughts move from head to heart to stomach. Everything is centered there. My grip tightens. My breath is held in anticipation as I try to envision the inner workings. Then I feel and hear a click in the hand holding the knob. A smile forms on my face. I turn the knob and the door swings open. I can't believe I can unlock doors by imagining what is inside of them. The kitchen is surprisingly clean. The surface is wiped down, the sink free of dirty dishes. A new loaf of bread sits on the counter. I walk through a narrow corridor into a living room with sports posters and banners on the walls. A big screen TV sitting in a corner. The door to a bedroom is off to the left side. I poke my head in. It's in a state of disarray. Covers thrown aside on the bed, clutter atop the dresser, the foul stench of dirty laundry covered in sweat that has never dried. At the front of the house, beside the door, a flight of stairs ascends to the second level. I begin walking up them. The third step groans under my foot.
Hello?
A voice yells from the top of the stairs. I freeze, holding my breath.
Frank, is that you?
I stay silent. I hear somebody stand from a chair, the creak of footsteps on a hard wood floor approaching. A man appears at the top of the stairs, dark shaggy hair, sideburns, an unshaven face. Not as big as the man who left earlier, but not exactly small either.
Who the hell are you?
He asks. I'm looking for a friend of mine, I say. He screws his face up into a scowl, vanishes, and reappears 5 seconds later, holding a wooden baseball bat in his hand.
How did you get in here?
He asks. I would put the bat down if I were you.
How did you get in here?
I am faster than you are, and I am far stronger.
Like hell you are.
I'm looking for a friend of mine. He came here this morning. I want to know where he is.
You're one of them, aren't you?
I don't know who you are talking about.
You're one of them,
he screams. He holds the bat as a baseball player would, both white-knuckled hands at the thin base poised to swing. There is genuine fear in his eyes. His jaw is tightly clenched.
You're one of them! Why don't you just leave us alone already?
I am not one of them. I've come for my friend. Tell me where he is.
Your friend is one of them!
No, he isn't.
So you know who I'm talking about?
Yes. He takes a step down. I'm warning you, I say. Drop the bat and tell me where he is. My hands are shaking from the uncertainty of the situation, from the fact that he has a bat in his hands while I have nothing but my own abilities. I'm unnerved by the fear in his eyes. He takes another step down. There are only 6 stairs between us.
I'm going to take your head off. That'll send your friends a message.
They aren't my friends, and I assure you, you'd be doing them a favor if you hurt me.
Let's see then,
he says. He comes racing down the stairs. There is nothing I can do but react. He swings the bat. I duck, and it hits the wall with a thud, leaving a large splintered hole in the wood panel. I come up after him and lift him in the air, one hand gripping his throat, the other in his armpit, carrying him back up the stairs. He flails, landing kicks to my legs and groin. The bat drops from his hands. It bounces hollowly down the stairs, and I hear one of the windows break behind me. The second floor is a wide open loft. It is dark. The walls are covered with issues of They Walk Among Us. And where the issues end, alien paraphernalia takes up the rest. But unlike Sam's, the posters are actual photographs taken over the years, blown up and grainy so that it is hard to make them out. Mostly white blips on black backdrops. A rubber alien dummy with a noose around its neck sits in the corner. Somebody has added a Mexican sombrero to its head. Glow-in-the-dark stars are stuck to the ceiling. They seem out of place. More like something belonging in a 10-year-old girl's room. I throw the man to the ground. He scoots away from me and stands up. When he does, I put all my power into the pit of my stomach and direct it towards him with a hard, forward-thrusting motion, and he goes flying backwards and crashes into the wall. Where is he? I ask.
I'll never tell you. He's one of you.
I'm not who you think I am. You guys will never succeed. Just leave Earth alone. I lift my hand and choke him. I can feel the flexed tendons beneath my hand, even though I am not touching him. He can't breathe, and his face turns red. I let go. I'll ask again.
No!
I choke him once more, but this time, when his face turns red, I squeeze tighter. When I let go, he begins to cry, and I feel bad for him, for what I've done to him. But he knows where Henri is, has done something to him, and my sympathy ends almost as soon as it began. After he catches his breath, and between sobs, he says,
"He's downstairs."
"Where? I didn't see him."
"I'm in the basement. The door is behind the Steelers banner in the living room."
I dial my phone number from the telephone atop the middle desk. Sam doesn't answer. Then I pull the phone from the wall and break it in half.
"Give me your cell phone," I say. "I don't have one."
I walk to the dummy and remove the noose from around its neck.
"Come on, man," he pleads.
"Shut up. You've kidnapped my friend. You're holding him against his will. You're lucky all I'm doing is tying you up." I pull his arms behind him and tie the rope tightly around them, then tie him to one of the chairs. I don't think that it will hold him for very long. Then I duct tape his mouth shut so that he can't yell, and I sweep down the stairs and rip the Steelers banner from the wall, revealing a black door that is locked. I unlock it as I did the other. A set of wooden stairs leads down to total darkness. The smell of mildew reaches my nose. I flip the light switch on and begin walking down, slowly, terrified at what I might find. The rafters are littered with cobwebs. I reach the bottom and immediately feel the presence of somebody else. Somebody there with me. I stiffen, take a deep breath, and then turn. There in the corner of the basement sits Henri.
Henri!
He is squinting from the light, his eyes adjusting. A length of duct tape is across his mouth. His hands are bound behind him. His ankles tied to the legs of the chair in which he is sitting. His hair is tousled, and down the right side of his face is a line of dried blood that looks almost black. The sight of it fills me with rage. I rush over to him and rip the piece of tape from his mouth. He takes a deep breath.
"Thank God,"
he says. His voice is weak.
"You were right, John. It was foolish to come here. I'm sorry. I should have listened."
"Shh," I say. I bend down and begin untying his ankles. He smells like urine.
"I was ambushed."
"How many are there?" I ask.
"Three."
"I've tied one of them up upstairs," I say. I free his ankles. He stretches his legs out and sighs with relief.
"I've been in this damn chair all day."
I begin working his hands free.
"How in the hell did you get here?"
he asks. "Sam and I came together. We drove down."
"You're kidding me."
"I had no other way."
"What did you drive?"
"His father's old truck." Henri is silent a minute while he ponders what that means. "He doesn't know anything," I say. "I told him aliens are a hobby of yours, nothing more." He nods.
"Well, I'm happy you made it. Where is he now?"
"Trailing one of them. I don't know where they went." The creak of a floorboard comes from above us. I stand, Henri's hands only halfway untied.
"Did you hear that?"
I whisper. We both watch the door with our breaths held. A foot steps onto the top stair, and then a second. And all at once, the large man I passed earlier, the one Sam was trailing, comes into view.
"The party's over, fellas,"
he says. He is holding a gun aimed at my face.
"Now step away."
I hold my hands up in front of me and take a step back. I think of using my powers to pull the gun away,
But what if I somehow cause it to fire by accident? I'm not confident in my abilities just yet. It's too risky.
They told us you might be coming, that you would look like humans,